KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Last week, the U.S. Senate managed to make its way to compromise over everything from college loan interest rates to some of President Obama's administrative appointments. What might they bond over this week? We'll talk with CBS News Capitol Hill producer Jill Jackson just after 10 o'clock. A couple of weeks back, investigators issued a report finding that the King County Sheriff's Office needed to make some changes in its internal monitoring practices. That finding came as part of a longer investigation into a 2012 shooting case. Although he wasn't sheriff at the time, John Urquhart is the man in charge these days. He joins us in the studio to talk more about changes he plans to make at his office, and it's great to have you in here.
Thank you, Marcy. Glad to be here.
Well, this was the Theo Harris case. Can you walk us back and explain again what happened in 2012?
This was in February of 2012 down in Auburn, and the Department of Corrections had gone in there to check on another man. The Department of Corrections specialist was embedded in the sheriff's office. We worked very closely with him. So our detectives went along with him. And they got to the house and they found who they were looking for. They arrested him. Then they learned there was another man living in the basement. And the Department of Corrections specialist and our detective went down there to check on him. This is about 5 to 8 minutes into their operation. They go in there. Their bedroom's dark. Dustin Theo Harris is in bed. They think he's reaching for a weapon, so they shot him. And they shot him 16 times between the two detectives. Luckily, they didn't kill him, but he obviously was severely, severely injured. And, in fact, there was no weapon. Now, it was investigated by the sheriff's office. It was investigated by the Department of Corrections. State Patrol looked at our investigations. There was a review by the King County Prosecutor's Office that said state law had not been violated. And there was an administrative investigation that found that the shooting – and everybody found that the shooting was justified. By the same token, there were problems, I think, in the way the investigation was conducted. And that's what I was faced with when I was sworn in on November 28th of 2012.
Is there in place a set of procedures in an instance like this when there is an officer shooting?
Oh, absolutely. There's a very prescribed, very specific set of procedures. The question is, are those procedures best practice for 2013? And frankly, I don't think they are. And I didn't think they were when I came into the office. And so that's what I'm changing now.
One of the findings from this investigator was that one of the procedures is that there's a 72-hour delay between the time of the shooting and the time when the officer involved is questioned. And 3 days, what's the rationale behind that delay?
Well, actually, it's set in a union contract. And we can't interview the deputy involved until at least 72 hours. Then it's up to us after that. And there is it's in our contract, like I said, and there is a thought that you get a better statement when the detective is allowed to calm down, so on and so forth. I don't agree with that, quite frankly, but that's what their argument is. The problem is it's in the contract now. It's something we've been done in all police departments. Virtually all police departments do this for many, many, many years. But the thinking has changed. The thinking has evolved. And I want to, as a sheriff, I want to be able to decide when we're going to interview that deputy. And right now we're in contract negotiations. And that's one of the sticking points.
So you want to decide, would it be a situational decision or would you like another time, a specific time allotted?
It's absolutely situational. We do when a citizen is involved in a shooting or a crime or a suspect, we decide when we're going to interview that person. And it might be right away. It might be at the scene, but it might not. There are situations where we'd prefer to wait. But I want that to be my decision, not something that's written down in a union contract.
We're talking with King County Sheriff John Urquhart, and you mentioned that contract negotiations are underway. I understand the sheriffs have been working for 7 months, I guess, since the contract expired in January. Is this a major sticking point?
Well, it's one of the sticking points. There's others as well. It's what the role of the Office of Law Enforcement Oversight is going to be inside the Sheriff's Office. And, of course, salary is a sticking point as well. It always is. The fact that they've been without a contract for 7 months is neither here nor there. That happens quite frequently. I think the Seattle Police didn't have a contract for a couple of years. We don't want to go that long. And in fact, we're in mediation right now.
You mentioned oversight, and a lot of our listeners may be familiar with the fact that the Seattle Police Department is in the midst of trying to come to terms with the Department of Justice consent decree. It's going to be, at least as I understand it, several year process of meeting the terms, making reforms. And it got me to wondering, we don't hear as much about the King County Sheriff's Department. What kind of external oversight is exerted on your department?
Well, there's lots of it. But the most formal part of it, the Office of Law Enforcement Oversight, is relatively new. It was passed by ordinance, King County Council Ordinance, about 2009. It's up and running now. Charles Gaither is a man that's in charge. But there are still – getting that to where it needs to be has still been problematic because primarily the union contract. But it is up and operating. He's the one that hired Merrick Bob to do this latest review. I meet with him, if not monthly, more often. He looks at everything we do. He wants to be able to look at more. I think he should be able to look at more. I think he should have a more active role. We have nothing to fear. Police departments and the sheriff's office in particular has nothing to fear from civilian oversight, from somebody looking over our shoulder. And we need that. And we need a robust plan for that.
Why do you need that? What does it add when you have a civilian component?
It adds credibility. I can come here and be on your show day in and day out and tell you what a good job we do investigating our own, and we do, but it doesn't mean anything. I don't have that credibility. I shouldn't have that credibility. You should always be suspicious of what the police chief or the sheriff says. You should question him or her. We need that outside oversight, that independent oversight that comes from a Charles Gaither, that comes from an Office of Law Enforcement Oversight.
You mentioned that Charles Gaither had hired Merrick Bob, and Merrick Bob is also involved with the reform process in the Seattle department, somebody from Los Angeles. This is what he does.
That's right. He is the monitor for the Seattle Police Department to make sure that the Department of Justice recommendations are being implemented, and he will report back to the Department of Justice. This was a side contract he took with us.
While he was up in Seattle, he could
look at it. He was here anyway.
We are talking with John Urquhart, who's the pretty recently elected sheriff. I believe November was your election date, and you are up for a re-election again this November. Pretty quick little stint that you
back-to-back elections. That's exactly right. It was a special term last year, a special election to fill out the last year of Sue Rahr's term. I beat my opponent, and so I'm the sheriff this year. I'm up for election, but I don't have an opponent, so I'm fairly confident I'll be the sheriff for the next 4 years.
The sheriff's office, unlike the Seattle police chief, is an elected it's an elected position. How do you think that, I guess, what accountability does that give you to your citizenry that Seattle's police chief doesn't have?
Well, the first thing it does, it takes politics out of the equation. Right now, Mayor McGinn runs the Seattle Police Department. I mean, that's very, very, very obvious. The sheriff's office, I run the sheriff's office. I answer to the citizens of King County. They can vote me out. They can vote me in. They can keep me in. They can do anything they want to. And I don't have to answer to anybody except the voters. And that's a huge difference. And it's a very important difference, I think.
So you have no oversight by the county council or county executive?
Oh,
Constantine?
Yes. Oh, yes. I don't have to answer them, but I have oversight. People that aren't happy with the job that the sheriff's office is doing, they can go to the county executive. They can go to the county council. They can go to the King County Ombudsman's office. They can certainly come to the sheriff's office. They can go to the Office of Law Enforcement Oversight. They can do all of that, just like they can in Seattle. But I don't have to ask permission from anybody before I make a political statement, for example, before I support Initiative 502 that I think we're going to talk about. I don't have to get permission of the county executive.
So, but they set your budget.
They set my budget.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, that's sort of a big thing.
And in fact, the council hired Merrick Bob to the tune of $25,000 to do this latest investigation. It's all a question of making what we do transparent. That's what's so important with government, and it's especially important with any police department.
One thing that I'd like you to clarify is where King County sheriffs have jurisdiction, because there are municipalities that have their own police department. So where are your officers responsible for policing?
Well, we have jurisdiction anywhere in the state of Washington under state law, but we are the primary police department for about 560,000 people that live in unincorporated King County. That's about 253,000 people, but also the citizens that live in cities that have contracted with the sheriff's office for police services, and there's 12 of those. Cities like Woodinville and Shoreline, Maple Valley, Covington, SeaTac, Burien, plus the Muckleshoot Indian Reservation, plus Sound Transit, plus Metro Transit. So there's 560,000 people that if they pick up the telephone and call 911, a sheriff's deputy shows up. He may be in a uniform that says Burien on it, but it's actually a sheriff's deputy.
Wow.
In addition, there are certain things in the state of Washington that only sheriff's officers can do, such as evictions. So anywhere in King County, including the city of Seattle, if you're being evicted or you have civil papers that need to be served, it's only a sheriff's detective that can do that.
Why?
State law. It's historical. State law.
Interesting.
Sheriff's office is responsible for search and rescue operations anywhere in King County. So we have, and King County's 2,200 square miles, almost 2 million people. We're the second largest local agency in the state of Washington. I've got 1,000 employees and a $160 million budget. I keep pretty busy.
You know, when people hear the word sheriff, they may think of people, they may think Matt Dillon or, Andy of Mayberry. What is the difference? It's a question I always wondered, between a sheriff and a police officer.
The biggest difference is a sheriff is elected and a police chief is appointed. Typically, a sheriff's office is for unincorporated areas of a county that aren't in a city, with the exception that I just mentioned, and a police chief is inside a city, a city police department.
Many people who live in Seattle use the downtown transit tunnel, as it's called now. Not that long ago, I was down in the tunnel, and a King County sheriff was there with a working dog with his own badge. When, and as you mentioned, the officers of your department are responsible for Metro Transit and Sound Transit, which use that tunnel, are there any jurisdictional conflicts because that tunnel runs through Seattle? For example, if there is some crime perceived by one of your sheriffs and the perpetrator ascends the escalator onto the streets of Seattle, who's in charge?
Either one of us are.
You know, really?
We have primary responsibility for the tunnel. But remember, we're for Metro Transit, which goes all over King County, for Sound Transit, heavy rail, which goes all over three counties, and for light rail, which goes down to the airport. We are their police department. But quite often, we're not there when there's a crime occurred. Maybe it's a park and ride lot. Maybe it's one of the stations. So the local police department will go, and either they'll investigate the crime or they'll wait till we get there. But we work very closely, and we work very well with all these different police agencies, including the Seattle Police Department downtown. We go back and forth all the time. We help them out during the torchlight parade. We help them out when there's demonstrations. We work very, very closely together with them. And that's what I'm really happy about. As Jim Pugel has come in as the new chief, he and I are working together very closely. We've got a great relationship. We're facing some of the same things. I want to learn from his challenges that he has with the Department of Justice and with civilian oversight. And I think they can learn from us.
So what you're saying, in a sense, is that you're being proactive in terms of the sorts of reforms that the Seattle Police Department in particular is now mandated to put into effect. You want to get the jump on that.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. Yes.
John Urquhart, King County Sheriff, is in our studios right now. You mentioned earlier Initiative 502. That is the initiative that voters approved in November that legalizes marijuana. What are challenges for your department in terms of trying to enforce that law?
Well, the first challenge, I think, is this is a huge cultural change for us and for me. Remember, I've been a police officer for 36 years. I spent a good part of that as a narcotics investigator. I've arrested a lot of people for possession or sales of marijuana, and now that's all out the window. So I had to think long and hard before I supported 502. And I came to a couple conclusions. First of all, the war on drugs hasn't worked. It's pretty much been a failure. And I thought it was time to change. I thought it was time to listen to the people of the state of Washington and see what they had to say. And they pretty much overwhelmingly wanted to legalize simple possession of marijuana. And I think that's a good thing. Let's try something different, because what we've done for 40 years or more hasn't worked. So I'm very pleased about that. So now the challenge is, how do we implement that with our own people? Smoking in public, smoking marijuana in public is still illegal. It's still illegal under federal law. So I mandated that my officers can't smoke marijuana, even though it's legal in the state of Washington. We've loosened up a little bit on prior use for hiring, those types of things. But we still have a huge problem with medical marijuana that 502 didn't address at all. That's the next thing that has to be addressed. And we have a huge problem with the money that these businesses are going to collect. The tax estimates were $0 to $700 million just in taxes. So you think about the cash flowing into these businesses, and right now they can't open a bank account. That's got to get fixed, or I'm going to be faced with a huge problem of robberies of these cash businesses, not to mention keeping track of them for business tax purposes.
I know that that's something that at least part of Washington's congressional delegation is trying to address. And when we talked to Representative Adam Smith, he said he didn't think it was going to get much traction, partly because there's only a couple of states in which marijuana is legal at this point.
That's exactly right. But there's more and more states. Article in the paper today about growing hemp. Mm-hmm. Denny Heck has a very good bill that's he's going to try to pass in the legislature. I support that bill. I'm going to be talking to some of the representatives. I'm good friends with Representative Dave Reichert. He and I are going to have lunch here in a couple of weeks, and it's going to be a part of our table talk.
At former sheriff of King County.
Former sheriff, absolutely.
One of the problems that strikes me is that there is now a state license that one can apply for and perhaps receive to both grow and dispense marijuana. But there are still likely to be many people who are illegally growing, and dispense is a legal term. Illegal sales will likely continue. That strikes me to be a big challenge for your officers and for police officers everywhere.
I think that's right. One of the reasons I supported 502 is try to get the illegality out of it, the sales. Right now, it's as we speak, it's legal to possess marijuana. It's not legal to buy or sell it. So unless it falls out of the sky, how do these people get a hold of it? And I think we both know the answer to that. And that's going to continue. You know, I'm trusting the Liquor Control Board. They're the ones that are setting up the rules and regulations to do this in a way that's going to work. I think it worked for many, many years with alcohol, and they're going to have to kind of do the same thing. But we've got to get the criminal element as best we can out of the sale of marijuana.
So will narcotics officers in the sheriff's department be focusing their attentions on harder drugs as opposed to marijuana?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We see somebody smoking in a bus shelter, smoking marijuana in a bus shelter, or smoking cigarettes. We'll take enforcement action. But the possession, we're not going to worry about that.
How big a problem is heroin in the county?
Huge problem. It's the new drug of choice. It's cheap. It's plentiful. People are trying it. Teenagers are trying it. Teenagers are dying from it. And it's different types of drugs ebb and flow, whether it's cocaine, powder cocaine, rock cocaine, meth, or heroin. And heroin is the new scourge right now in King County.
Is that coming up from Mexico?
Yes.
Anything that you guys can do to try to slow the flow?
We do the best we can. We count on the feds to do a lot as well.
We're talking with John Urquhart. He is King County Sheriff. And as I mentioned, you're running for reelection. And there's been some interesting op-eds, things about early childhood education. But it got me to wondering, you know, here's your campaign speech for a few minutes. What are your priorities in this office? You've been with the sheriff's department for many years.
Well, I've had several priorities as I came in. One of the first things I did was I grounded our drones. I wasn't happy with the drone project. I don't think the public was ready for it. So I found out that we actually had one, and I grounded it, and then I sent it back. I think it's a great police tool, but the public isn't ready for it yet. Let's wait. Really what I've been focused on primarily is reforming how we investigate officer-involved shootings. And one of them was the 72 hours that we talked about. The other thing that came out of the Merrick Bob report is our administrative investigation has not started until the end of our criminal investigation. And that's caused a lot of problems.
And an administrative investigation is the investigation into the officer.
The policy. Did the officer and the officers around him or her follow our proper policies, our administrative policies, totally different from the other investigation to find out exactly what happened. And it's been late. It hasn't happened on a timely basis. We haven't gotten the statements on a timely basis. And a lot of this was on advice from our attorneys. Well, attorneys give advice. They don't tell you how to do it. So I've changed that. We now have an administrative review team that will go out at the same time that our investigating detectives go out. There will be concurrent investigation.
One of the things that Charles Gaither mentioned and came out in that Merrick Bob report also had to do with the role of supervisory officers. You're all called officers. But if there's an officer-involved shooting, as I understand it, one of the issues was that the sergeant who was sent out to investigate acted as advocate for the officer involved in the shooting. And it seemed like there was a murky relationship between who was looking into an administrative investigation and who was advocating for an officer.
I think there's been some misreporting on that. The first sergeant on the scene, who was the patrol sergeant that was working, so he goes there immediately after the shooting. He has a tremendous amount of things he has to do, make the proper notifications, secure weapons, all kinds of things. He went there and he did that, did exactly what his job was. He sent the involved officers to a different location, away from the scene, keep them sequestered. He did all of that correctly. Now, when he got all that done, and it was probably an hour and a half afterwards, then he went to where those officers were, and he put on his union hat, because coincidentally, he is an officer in the union. So when he got there, now he had inside information because he'd been at the shooting scene, and that's a problem, and we need to keep that from happening. That being said, we've got 101 sergeants. We have one that's a union officer. Coincidentally, he happened to be on duty that night. But it's something never happened before. We need to look into that. We need to fix that aspect of it. But there was nothing nefarious involved. I don't think there was anything that was wrong about it. But it brings up this question, and that's why we're talking about it today.
Right. We would call it in the journalism business conflict of interest. So
yes.
In your mind, you think that should be separated?
Absolutely.
Perhaps if that officer happened to be on duty, you might say, hey, you're the union rep. Let's find someone else to go out.
Yeah. He has to be the responding patrol sergeant first. Has to do that because he's out there. Somebody else has to come and do the union job. I agree it's a conflict of interest. I don't think it's particularly egregious. It's just something we need to look at.
How many officer-involved shootings have happened in the sheriff's department in the last year?
Since I've been sheriff, so November, so 7 months, one. We have one or two a year, if that. Sometimes not even that. Not very many.
And while we're on this topic, and with like 30 seconds I have left, what's your position on gun control?
I don't like seeing gun control reduced to a bumper sticker. That's what both sides have done. That doesn't help the problem at all. It's a question of violence in America. That doesn't help when you reduce the issue to a bumper sticker saying.
What's the first step towards addressing violence in America?
There is no first step. Talking about it, I guess. It's a huge, huge problem. Guns are part of that. There's no question about that.
John Urquhart is King County Sheriff. You'll see his name unopposed, I guess, on the November
unopposed
ballot.
Unopposed for sure.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:30. In a minute here, the joys and challenges of photographing nature, and in particular, the challenges of photographing owls. Why is photographing owls particularly tricky? We're about to find out.
Support for KUOW comes from Athena Health, offering physicians a dinner seminar on how to manage the challenges of healthcare payment reform, Thursday, July 25th at the W Seattle. Details at athenahealth.com/WANPR.
57 degrees in Seattle under a cloudy sky. Forecast calls for sun this afternoon and a high of 78. Tomorrow, more sun, a high of 82, and then it's supposed to be sunny all week, at least by afternoon, with temperatures in the 70s and 80s. 9:31, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Mary Lambert sang on Macklemore's hit song, Same Love. This is her.
And I can't change, even if I try.
Now Mary Lambert's releasing a song of her own, Words and Music, with writer, poet, performer, and activist Mary Lambert,
15 minutes from now.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Wildlife photographer Paul Banik won a Canon Award for his photograph of a snowy owl taken at ocean shores. Katie Sewell met with Banik to talk about the joys and challenges of protecting and photographing nature, which doesn't always go very smoothly. Katie asked Paul about a trip he took to photograph gray owls in the Sierra.
The day I was about to photograph the nest, the tree fell over and the nest failed. And there's a message in that. There's a powerful message in that. I had been photographing this year. I photographed great grays in the Southern Cascades in Oregon, in the Tetons in Idaho. And in past years, I've photographed them in Alaska as well. Great gray owls are a platform nester. So they nest either on the abandoned nest of a raptor like a goshawk or a red-tailed hawk or maybe a corvid like a raven, or they nest in broken top trees or in mistletoe mats. But either way, they need that platform. Great gray owls have given a choice, preferred broken off trees. Well, the great gray owl is the largest owl in North America. It's 27 inches long and has a 5-foot wingspan. It's huge. So it needs a large tree to nest in. Well, think about what it takes to create a large tree, a lot of time and being left alone. Now, great gray owls want an old snag that's soft enough where they can just dig a little bit out of the top and they can settle down in that top of that tree and lay their eggs. Owls don't create nests. So by the time the tree is ready to accommodate that owl, it's also vulnerable to falling over. So this owl finds this nest. Finally, it's right for it. It sits down and it's lucky to get a season or two out of that nest before the tree falls over. And I thought about that. I was bummed because I had spent I'd bought the plane ticket, I'd rented a car, I'd spent all this time, and the tree fell over. But it really drove home a lesson. And that's the lesson that when we're thinking about conserving habitat, we have to think about what provides homes for animals today, but also tomorrow. So for instance, if you're looking at the health of a forest, leaving a snag, an existing large snag today, but leaving no aging trees, no trees that might form the snags of tomorrow, will only make us feel good about having that animal there today, but it's not providing for the needs of tomorrow.
So I'm curious for you, when you're out there doing these photographs, can you tell us, you're sitting in a blind, how do you build a blind?
Well, you could build a blind or you can erect a blind. I put a blind, I actually had some help putting my last blind together. I was sitting up in the Southern Cascades, 20 feet up in a tree, watching a great gray owl nest. And by the way, while I was up there, I was watching the owl, and suddenly the female started complaining. And when she complains, you know, because she goes, ooh, ooh, ooh. And I'm looking around trying to see what the problem is. And suddenly I'm hearing this squealing and the squealing. Well, actually, she flew off the nest. Suddenly I'm hearing the squealing. The squealing sounds like a dog that loves you and it's suddenly been punished and it's squealing in shame, running away with its tail between its legs. I was hearing that sound. Well, I had covered this blind in branches, so I couldn't see out the side and the sound was to the side. So quickly I'm parting these branches and poke my head through and I see this large, scruffy, cinnamon-colored black bear running, leaping over logs, squealing. And the mother owl was chasing the bear away. And the incredible experiences like that in the blind.
Is there a creature that you've always wanted to photograph that you've never been able to capture?
Yes, there's several. One would be the Canada lynx. I've never photographed the Canada lynx. And the lynx is a boreal animal. It's shy, it's large, it's beautiful, and it's another indicator species. It needs deep snows, and it occurs in two parts of Washington State, up in the Loomis area of Washington State and also in the Columbia Highlands. I've always wanted to photograph the lynx, and the second one is the wolverine. And the wolverine is being found in Washington State recently. There's more of them than we thought. And both of these animals require connectivity to Canada, which is part of the work I'm working on with Conservation Northwest in my day job. But they're two animals I would love to photograph.
Is it difficult to work in conservation every day?
It is difficult. it's difficult because you're always in a position of trying to protect and feeling the pieces you've protected being whittled away. But I tell you what's encouraging, Katie, and this has been particularly in this last year. This is the third conservation organization I've worked for. And what's really been rewarding is every other time you felt the pieces whittled away. But in these last 2 to 3 years, we've seen animals returning. We've seen wolves returning. We're finding wolverines in new places. Mm-hmm. We're having the opportunity to study the recovery of lynx. So even though there's pieces being bitten away, these animals remind us of the success we've had, because now the Cascades are wilder than they've ever been, and it's thanks to the work we've done. And so what it reminds us is we have the opportunity. And I'll back up and say, when you're protecting one specific place, you can feel the opportunity whittle away. But when you're actually building resiliency into the system, it's like you're creating something eternal. And that has a degree of hope that the conservation field in general doesn't give you if you're working on many different issues. But the idea that we can build lifelong, in fact, you know, as long as the world's around, well, we can't say that, but we can say for decades ahead, we can build the resiliency of the landscape by connecting broad habitat areas. And then people can have jobs, people can have homes, they can do what they're going to do. But if we're smart about which lands to protect, the wildlife can then take care of themselves, and they could breed with unrelated individuals. They can come down from Canada. They can come over from the Rockies. And to me, that's the dream that gets me excited. And that gives me the idea and really the belief that I'm going to see a wilder Washington in 10 years than I have today, because we understand those systems better. And do you know that Washington State is the only state in the country that has a connectivity working plan, where actually the Department of Transportation has recognized the need for connectivity and has adopted the maps that we have endorsed to have a plan on which roads should and shouldn't be built, which roads need to be taken out, where there needs to be overpasses and underpasses. That's incredibly progressive. And that has, you know, implications for years ahead.
What part of the state are you seeing the most encouraging thought going into it?
As far as I'm concerned, the most important thing we can do is build resiliency into the Cascades. And two things have to happen. We have to have connectivity to the Coast Range, and we have to have connectivity to the Rockies. And connectivity to the Rockies requires that we have a plan to connect the Cascades across northeastern Washington, through the Rockies, going through the area that we call the Columbia Highlands, and that includes the Kettle Range, the Okanagan Highlands, and the Selkirks. The challenge, Katie, is that involves working with private land and public land, and we're working on both parts of that. Right now, we're trying to raise money to buy conservation easements. So essentially, it's really hard to be a rancher today. It's hard to make a living. But if we can offer conservation easements, not only can they make a living because they get money, but their land will not be developed. It won't turn into ranchettes or subdivisions. The wildlife doesn't care how land's designated. They don't care if it's a wilderness or if it's a national forest or if it's a conservation easement. But this is allowing us to fill in the key gaps that can't be handled through the acquisition of land or the designation of wilderness. The thing is, though, the time is now, because this is one of the few benefits of a weak economy is the land is relatively cheap. So we can do this now. But when the economy recovers, as more people move in the future, it's going to be harder to do. So right now is the opportunity to make this connectivity that will fill this vision that I'm talking about wilder Cascades.
Well, maybe just to end, and I'm speaking with Paul Bannock, who's a wildlife photographer and is the Director of Development at Conservation Northwest. I'd be interested to know, after spending all this time in nature, and particularly lately watching owls and woodpeckers and these creatures, besides the fact that you work in conservation, has watching them for long, extended periods of time sort of changed your perspective on how you see the world or
that is such a
how
great
you live
question.
Your life? I mean, beyond all the conservation work
you're
doing.
I love the question, and I don't have an immediate answer, so give me a second as I formulate this. I'll tell you some ideas that have occurred to me, particularly these last 3 months of my sabbatical. I spent a career in computer software, and it was go, go, go. I grew up one of 13 kids, so I worked in computer software, and my dream was always to work in conservation, but I never knew I'd have the chance. So here I'm doing it. And I was out there in the field, and what occurred to me is this is so good for me because I tend to think big picture, and I tend to think things like this connectivity we're talking about. But what watching the animals forces me to do is to ignore what I want and ignore my constraints, ignore whether I'm comfortable or uncomfortable, ignore my sense of time, and not to be focused on the big picture, but instead to very, very carefully watch and pay attention to that animal. And when I was 20 feet in the tree, eye level with this nest, I was watching this bird, and I had to try to get inside its head and guess what it was feeling and what it was about to do and when it was about to move and why. You know, when is it going to cuddle up and put its wings over the chicks? When is it going to fly off and hunt? When is the male going to arrive with food? And I was no longer in control, and I couldn't be distracted by anything but watching on a micro level nature in its beauty and its spirit. And without being behind the lens, that's sometimes a hard thing to do.
Paul Bannick is a wildlife photographer who specializes in the natural history of North America with a focus on birds and habitat. He's also the director of development for Conservation Northwest and the author of The Owl and the Woodpecker. And thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Katie.
This is Weekday.
Paul Bannick spoke with KUOW's Katie Sewell. It's 9:43. 58 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 78 this afternoon with sun later. Overnight, a clear sky, a low of 58, and tomorrow, Tuesday, sunny with a high of 82.
On the next Living on Earth, we meet a chef with a surprising cuisine, bugs.
You know, I really like wax worms. These are small caterpillars. When you actually roast them, they taste like pistachio nuts. It's like, what's not to like?
I'm Steve Kerwin, and we have a different take on animal protein next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Among the recipes that will be discussed, fried green tomato hornworms and 3B salad. How to eat bugs tonight at 10 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Hello, this is Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media. The programs you hear on KUOW are all commercial-free, and that's probably one of the reasons you listen. It's also one of the reasons your financial support is so important to us. Join the thousands who support commercial-free news and information. Make your gift today. Just go online to KUOW.org, and thanks.
It's 9:44. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Washington State's new drunk driving law in the news at 10.
And I can't change, even if I tried, even if I wanted to.
Was gay, I would think hip-hop hates me. Have you read the YouTube comments lately? Man, that's gay, gets dropped on the daily. We become so numb to what we're saying. A culture founded from oppression. Yeah, we don't have acceptance for them. Call each other faggots behind the keys of a message board. A word rooted in hate, yet our genre still ignores it. Gay is synonymous with the lesser.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Macklemore and Ryan Lewis had a national hit with the tune Same Love, but if you took a moment to look at the credits, you'd see it says Macklemore and Ryan Lewis with Mary Lambert. And yes, Mary's is that voice that you heard at the beginning of the music. It appears in and out of the song, behind Macklemore's rap lyrics and up and on its own. And now Mary Lambert's releasing her single, She Keeps Me Warm, which is the song that you hear in Same Love. Mary Lambert's with us in the studio. I didn't know how to describe that, Mary. Because it's like two songs. It's not really behind. It's interwoven.
Yeah. I mean, it was great production on Ryan's part. But it was a song that I wrote for Same Love, you know.
You wrote the song for this?
Yeah, I wrote the chorus for Same Love and then have shaped the choruses around a new one.
So how did that collaboration come to be?
Oh, we were very fortunate to have a mutual friend, Hollis Wongware, and she's featured on White Walls, and she's like a brilliant human being to know. And they were working on this song, and they needed, a voice that was in the queer community that was also, you know, a songwriter. And so she approached me about it, and it just felt like this is a song that I've been needing to write forever. So it's really lucky.
Forever, given your relative youth. One of the things that's interesting is that when you hear hip-hop or rap, like Macklemore and Ryan Lewis have made their fortune on these days, I guess, it is a certain way. There's a cadence, and Same Love is melodic, it's tender, it's kind of sweet. And so you don't necessarily, as a listener, expect to find those two genres, even though the theme is the same.
Right.
the style is very different. So can you talk a little bit about the real process of weaving together those two things?
Yeah, I think the song was really unexpected, especially in the rap community and the hip-hop community. And I think it's one of a kind. And I think it's also one of those songs that people that, like, I don't really like rap, but I like this song, you know. And I think I think Ben and Ryan have a really great, they do a really great job of making songs with beautiful messages, with things that have substance and things that are also fun and catchy, you know, Thrift Shop and White Walls and things that are somewhat of a novelty. But I think the song was very unique in that sense of reaching to a much larger audience.
So your individual single, which is released today, today's its official day, an hour ago, was written in its entirety before this collaboration.
I wrote it for Same Love. And then I was getting requests, like, during shows of mine, just like, play Same Love. I was like, well, I don't really want to rap the whole thing. Like, plus, I don't know if I'm allowed to. You know, I would do a terrible, terrible job rapping. I could fake it. But I decided to craft a new song around it. And because I think there's another story with Same Love. I think there's more to say rather than it just being a political message. I think there's also a complete message of love. And rather than this being a political song with wanting to make a juxtaposition between Christianity and queerness, I think all I wanted to do is make a love song that just happened to be about a woman. And I hope that I've achieved that. That's sort of the goal. It's like, inadvertently, yes, I suppose that there's a stand involved in a proclamation of my gayness, but it's also, to me, more of a, it's just a love song to me. You know, it's just female pronouns.
You mentioned that you know, even if you had permission, you're not sure you could rap your way through Same Love. But you had an interesting path to the singer-songwriter career. Mm. You did do spoken word poetry. So when did you actually start writing music? Before the spoken word?
Or? Yeah, yeah. Music was my first love, always has been. My mother was a singer-songwriter, and everyone in my family is pretty musical. And so just growing up hearing my mom sing and write songs around the house was really inspiring. And so I started writing at a really young age to, you know, invisible, massive audiences at 7 years old. Take my bow. Like, I wrote this song when I was 7 years old. Like, have my interviews with Jay Leno. I was very serious about what I wanted to do. And then it just sort of continued. I went to Cornish for composing. And then I was going to go straight into teaching, actually.
And teaching music?
Yeah, I wanted to teach music in middle school. That's what I wanted to do.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, a little of a challenge, I think. But during Cornish actually is when I found spoken word, and it just happened to be, I think, because I moved to Seattle because the commute was getting too long from the North End. And when I discovered spoken word, it was like I had found this whole other art form that completed what things that I wanted to say, because there were things that I felt like I couldn't say in music, things that I wanted to say cut and dry, but you can't always say it as raw. You have to sort of make it technical and pretty it up and things like that. So, I've sort of gotten into this path and of being also doing spoken word. And
so you're still doing spoken word.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're talking with Mary Lambert, and She Keeps Me Warm, her new single, had its release 1 hour ago on her website, and then it will go global, right?
That's the hope.
How do you address different topics in the music than you do in the spoken word?
Yes. I think I'm working towards... spoken word for me is I think similar in the way that rap is, or I relate to Ben in a lot of ways, Macklemore, just because I think with many songs he does, it's very much of, he's a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And so each song really has its own story to tell. And for me, that's what spoken word is. That's what a poem is for me, is a whole story to it. And songwriting for me is, I think, more of an identity. And so it's all stories and pieces of this one larger puzzle, and that's usually just about being sad.
I understand that there's a lot of weeping that happens at your live shows. Here you are giggling away, but so when you put on that you stand in front of the mic and sing, mm-hmm. all that other kind of emotion comes out.
So weepy. But the nice thing, I think the nice thing about my shows is there's always this relief after a song, and I'll try to crack some jokes or, you know, make it a little bit more.
To cheer us up.
Yeah, you got it. I mean, it's good, but it's definitely a bipolar show. I mean, I always feel really bad for my audiences.
Well, Mary, you have such an interesting personal backstory. You mentioned that your mom was a singer-songwriter as well, but you sort of had this family that then became very, very religious, mm-hmm. super evangelical religion. And then your mom came out, mm-hmm. and then you came out.
Yeah.
And I was trying to envision what that sort of little Christian, heavy Christian part of your life was like in terms of your own personal identity.
It was so back and forth for a long time. So we were raised Pentecostal, very, I would call it psychotically Christian, very fundamentalist. And then my mom came out, and I think it was really jarring for the community we were in, and we were ostracized. So we were pretty much, kicked out of the church. And my mother was a single mother, you know, raising the both of us, and I don't know how she did it. But then, then I grew up sort of in drum circles and going to, you know, some finding some alternate spiritual paths. And we went to the church. It's actually the church that we filmed Same Love in, the church up on Capitol Hill. I'm blanking on
Pilgrim.
Yeah, all pilgrims. And so I think we went there a couple times. And then when I was in high school, I refound the evangelical church, and I loved it. I loved it because it was, people were so on fire for God, and I just loved being around people that were that passionate, and the music was good, and there were people that were tatted up and so cool looking, and they were totally about God, and I was like, I'm on board. But at the same time, the church I was attending at that time was still very against against homosexuality, and it wasn't hatred. They didn't call it hatred, and they never call it hatred. They call it love the sinner, hate the sin. But that rhetoric is still, it's not based in love. They think it's based in love. It's not based in love.
So you came out at 17.
Yeah, when I was 17.
And so did you leave this evangelical group?
I did leave the church. I at the time, I was attending this church, and I was also going to St. Mark's Cathedral on Capitol Hill. So I would have like 3 hours of church on Sunday.
Wow.
I just really, I loved going to church, and I'm still pretty traditional. But I would, once I realized I was gay, I was in the evangelical church, and I part of the lines in, one of the lines in Same Love is not crying on Sundays. And I spent probably about a year just crying at church. I just cried as I couldn't believe that I was going to go to hell for my love, for you know, a girl that I liked. And I think I finally got to a point where I was like, I can't apologize for this anymore. Because in my head, I was like, okay, well, I'm not, this can't change. I know that this is a part of my identity. Like, once I figured it out, it's like everything makes sense. But at least I can repent. At least I can apologize to God every day. And that's psychotic. I mean, it just, as 17, you already feel like a freak. And so to go through that is like an additional, like, freak fest. I don't know.
So what role does spirituality play for you now?
A big part. It's a big part of my life. I was really fortunate to find, you know, my current partner is also Christian. So we're both, you know, we're Christian lesbians, I guess. And I probably don't write about it as much in the same way that I've chosen to not really write with female pronouns because you don't want to alienate your audiences. But now that we've done Same Love and that I've seen that people, you know, like 15-year-old girls are singing She Keeps Me Warm and not batting an eyelash, you know, not even thinking about it, then I think it's given me strength to say, you know, I think that I can mention my faith and other parts of my identity in my music.
To just go back to the beginning of this conversation, this collaboration on Same Love, what did the fact that that song went global mean for you and your career?
After we recorded it, me and my partner were, you know, we're having champagne at Machiavelli's and we're cheersing and she's like, what if you go on Ellen? I'm like, I'll never go on Ellen. That's absurd. That's crazy. And then, like, you know, 6 months later, I'm freaking on Ellen. Like, it's just bananas. It's crazy. And so it feels like my world has turned around in the last year. Like, everything is like on its head. This time last year, I was working like 3 jobs. I was working, you know, serving and bartending. And now I am so fortunate to be able to have, you know, my full-time job is just music as an artist, is writing and performing. And I feel so fortunate to do that. And to see what Same Love has done, I think culturally, is hard to fathom for you. I think you always hope to change the world as an artist, as anybody. I mean, I think you want to make an impact, but rarely are people given the platform to do it. And I just feel like I've been given such a gift and I don't want to take it for granted. And I just want to keep doing what I'm supposed to do and doing what is good.
Mary Lambert, Seattle-based singer, songwriter, and spoken word poet. Her single, She Keeps Me Warm, had its official release today. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And here it is, She Keeps Me Warm.
Safety and home. I named both of her eyes forever and please don't go. I could be a morning sunrise all the time, yeah. This could be good, this could be good. And I can't change even if I try, even if I wanted to. And I can't change even if I tried, even if I wanted to. My love, my love, my love, my love.
That's Mary Lambert with She Keeps Me Warm on KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. It's 9:59. This afternoon, you'll have your last chance to tell the city what you want from the Bike Master Plan. The city wants to hear from you, and so do we. What would need to change to get you to ride a bike to work? We're going to go in-depth on that today during the...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.